So good morning and welcome. I'm Frank Verastro. I'm a senior vice president here at the center, and it's my pleasure to welcome you here this morning for the Energy Information Administration's International Energy Outlook. I'm also going to serve today as moderator, host, and safety officer, so let me do my safety stuff first. We don't expect an evacuation this morning. Should that happen, though, there's two exits from this area. So the first one, most obvious, the way you came in, down the stairs behind you, out the front door, and then we usually gather to the right of the Beacon Hotel. Second one is either through the exit signs behind me or by the elevators that takes you to an alleyway and brings you out by National Geographic, okay? Also, because of the size of the audience and the fact that there's a lot of people here today, we would like to have you mute or silence your cell phones for the folks around you, and then we'll get back to that. We will post the slides, but immediately after Linda's presentation, they'll also be available on the EIA website. Okay, so now for the substance. It's our great pleasure to host the EIA presentations, and we've done this for a number of years, both on the international side and the domestic annual energy outlook. We've had folks, including EIA alumni and CSIS alumni, Guy Caruso and Adam Siminski, and we're just so pleased to have this morning Linda Capuano. Well, Linda is the newest EIA administrator. She's the ninth in order, and we were talking back in the green room. I've actually had the pleasure or age of knowing all nine. I was like six at the time when they first started. Our program identifies Linda's many accomplishments, but I got to tell you, I was really thrilled when she was named in January to become the next administrator. She's had an exceptional career path. It's been long and distinguished even prior to her going to EIA. She's served on the faculty of the Jones Graduate School of Business at Rice. She's a fellow in energy technology at the Baker Institute. At Marathon, she served as a corporate officer. I knew her back in Marathon when we worked together on an MPC study. She was vice president for technology, and she's also held positions at Honeywell, Allied Signal Aerospace, and IBM. Her presentation today builds on the work done in last year's IEO in terms of looking at longer-term macro projections, energy demand, and CO2 emissions, but it also attempts to take a focused, deeper dive, and this is a little bit new for EIA. And we're going to look at three specific regions today that are critically important to future energy demand between now and 2040. And those are Africa, China, and India. And to change up the program a little bit from what we've seen in the past, immediately after Linda's presentation, we'll take a few questions at that time, but then we're going to invite to the stage three regional experts. And I'll introduce them when we bring them on board. But if you'll join me this morning in welcoming Linda Capuano. Thanks very much.
Today it's going to be a data-dense presentation, so this welcome you to the first presentation of the U.S. Energy Information Administration's International Energy Outlook for 2018. The IEO is one of two annual energy projections published by EIA under the Department of Energy Organization Act of 1977, which requires the EIA administrator to prepare annual reports on trends and projections for energy use and supply. The IEO 2018 projects aspects of the global energy system through 2040, but does not predict what will happen. It is a modeled projection of what may happen under certain assumptions and methodologies. EIA alternates the IEO emphasis each year. We did a full analysis in 2017. This year, we updated the IEO 2017 reference case with new macroeconomic information as a foundation to examine the effect of different growth patterns on international energy consumption, specifically the energy consumption of the rapidly growing economies of China, India, and Africa, which are likely to have a profound impact on international energy markets, including the U.S. energy exports. These economies also present different starting points and provide insight on the effect of varying industry structures and economic development pathways on the future energy consumption. As Frank said, you'll be able to download the IEO documents immediately at the end of this presentation, and CSIS will make the discussions, including the expert panel discussions, available on the website, and we thank CIS for hosting the IEO release. Now let me highlight some of these significant insights from the IEO. First, energy consumption in the non-OECD countries began to exceed OECD in 2007 and is projected to reach nearly two-thirds of the projected 739 quadrillion BTU global energy consumption in 2040. Second, the world's energy consumption through 2040 increases on average for all fuels in the reference case. The IEO side cases show higher economic growth drives increasing energy consumption, while services and manufacturing pathways to growth modulate that consumption. And next, the per capita energy consumption in India and Africa remain comparatively low despite high economic growth, and the side cases highlight the need to further explore the relationship between high economic growth, relative sizes of service and manufacturing sectors, and energy consumption. Now let's start with the reference case projections for, Now let's start with the reference case projections for world energy consumption, which is projected to grow by 28% from 2015 to 2040 to 739 quadrillion BTUs. Consumption in the non-OECD in brown began to exceed OECD in 2007, and we project that strong economic and population growth will increase their share to nearly two-thirds, or 64% of the world's energy consumption. This is a 1.4% per year increase compared to 0.4% for OECD countries. Also note that the average growth in world energy consumption averages 1% per year from 2015 to 2040, but there is a slight uptick to 1.1% between 2030 and 2040. Next graph gives a little bit more detail. We project that non-OECD Asia in red will increase 103 quadrillion BTU between 2015 and 2040, with China and India accounting for 68% of that growth. This is slower than the nearly 300% increase from 1990 to 2015, but in 2040 will account for 41% of the global energy consumption. Non-OECD regions outside of Asia are also projected to contribute substantially to increases in energy demand. In Africa, with a projected 3.8% per year GDP growth and nearly half the world's population growth is expected to account for 7% of the total global energy consumption increase, a 52% increase between 2015 and 2040. Since economic growth is an important factor driving energy consumption, the next slide compares the projected GDP growth details between 2015 and 2040 in the reference case. Over the next 25 years, non-OECD regions on the right are projected to have 4.1% average annual GDP growth compared to 1.7% for OECD on the left. India is projected to have the world's fastest growing economy, averaging 6% per year. China will have an average increase of 4.5% per year, which is slower compared with its growth of 8.1% over the last decade. And Africa is projected to average 3.8% per year. Now let's consider the types of energy consumed. And this gets interesting. This graph shows, in the reference case, the world's energy consumption through 2040 increases significantly for all fuels except nuclear and coal. Nuclear and coal grow at 1.5% and 0.1% respectively. As industrial demand for coal weakens, and in electricity power generation, coal is increasingly replaced by natural gas or renewables, and in the case of China, by nuclear power. So the overall decline of coal use in OECD regions is offset by the growth in coal use in India and other non-OECD Asian nations. Petroleum and other liquids in brown remain the largest source of energy and will meet much of the world's energy demand, but with only 0.7% per year growth, its share of the world's consumption will decline from 33% in 2015 to 31% in 2040. Natural gas in blue and renewables in green continue to gain at 1.4% and 2.4% per year, respectively. As I mentioned before, our model shows an uptick in world energy consumption between 2030 and 2040 being met by all forms of energy, with natural gas and renewables growing an average of 1.7% per year, petroleum and other liquids 0.9% per year, and coal 0.3% per year during that period. So now let's take a little bit of a deeper look. World industrial sector energy use in green increases by 16%, reaching 206 quadrillion BTU by 2040. 82% of the industrial sector energy use increase occurs in non-OECD nations, growing by 0.7% per year in the reference case, compared to 0.4% in the OECD countries. Energy use in all end-use sectors is projected to grow faster at 1.1% per year between 2015 and 2040 when compared to 0.6% per year for the industrial sector. However, the industrial sector continues to account for the largest share of world energy consumption, and in 2040 is about 17 quads higher than all other end-use sectors combined. Now let's move to the reference case, and from the reference case to the sensitivity cases for China, India, and Africa. This graph compares the industrial structure of Chinese, Indian, and African economies in 2015, which is the starting point for all of the IEO 2018 projections. China's story is well known. Manufacturing was 51 and services 33% of the total gross output in 2015. We assume that manufacturing gradually declines to 39% and services grow to 46% by 2040. And we increased our GDP assumption in the reference case to 5.7% compared to the 4.5% we used in 2017. And we considered two cases. The first, a more rapid transition to a consumption-led economy and increased demand for more services, which we call the fast transition case, where the personal consumption share of the GDP rises to 60% by 2040 compared to 50% in the reference case. In the no transition to services case, China continues its large industrial investment and export-led growth with 51% GDP investment share compared with 32% in the reference case. For India, projected to be the fastest growing economy, we increase our GDP assumption to 7.1% per year in the side case compared to 6% in the reference case and consider three growth pathways: an investment-led economy with more industrial sector investment, the investment share of the GDP rises from 29 to 38% in 2040, loosely patterned after China, an export-led economy with more output from trade-sensitive, energy-intensive industries such as chemicals and refining. The export share of the GDP increases from 23 to 55% in 2040. This is loosely patterned after the example of South Korea. And a personal consumption-led economy with more output from services, where the personal consumption share of the GDP rises from 61 to 67% in 2040 and is based upon the current U.S. levels of personal consumption. Africa was a bit more challenging because it's a collection of countries, and we assumed a GDP increase of 5% per year in the side cases compared with 3.8% in the reference cases. So now let's turn to China. This graph compares the annual growth rate of China GDP in brown and in the energy consumption in blue over the time period and shows that energy consumption began to slow in after 2005 and GDP to slow after 2008. China had double-digit real GDP growth for most of 1980 to 2005, while energy demand more than tripled, particularly in the 2000s as energy-intensive industrial manufacturing sector increased sharply. Over the past 5 years, China has consistently stated policy goals to lower the growth of energy consumption, and we see that demand is slowing simultaneously. We are also seeing the economy shift towards services. Interestingly, our model found that the higher economic growth rate of 5.7% per year used in both cases is the primary driver of energy consumption, while the pathway has a secondary modulating effect on that growth. Here we see that the industrial sector in dark blue accounts for the majority of energy consumption, where the large industrial demand of no transition to services economy results in 25% higher energy consumption when compared to the reference case, 137 quads compared to 110, while a faster transition to a services economy produces only a 20% increase, 130 quads compared to 110. Going deeper, here we see that that small changes in manufacturing share of total gross output drive larger changes in energy consumption. Higher assumption of Chinese economic growth appear to raise total output in manufacturing in dark blue, but not its relative share in the economy. The services sector share in yellow shows more variation, increasing from 41 to 48% when compared to no transition, when comparing the no transition to the fast transition case. Interestingly, while we have not examined it closely, the construction sector appears to be more responsive to our transition assumptions, increasing to 17% in the no transition case. And this is something we probably want to take a, at least take a closer look at as we examine this going into the next year. So now let's take a look at the global effect of faster Chinese economic growth. This slide compares, This slide considers global energy intensive manufacturing production across cases. China in blue remains the world's largest producer of energy intensive goods in 2040, regardless of its economic transition. More than double the next largest region, India in brown. Even in the fast transition case, where China's manufacturing share of domestic output declines to 38% of total output, China continues to gain global market share in energy-intensive goods production, increasing from 35% in the reference case to 40% in the fast transition case. Now let's look at per capita, and this gets a little interesting. This slide compares past and projected energy consumption versus GDP per person across different countries. We see the general increase in energy consumption per capita as GDP increases, but magnitudes are significantly different. Chinese energy consumption per person increases with GDP, but growth slows with the anticipated transition to less energy-intensive industries. However, Chinese energy consumption per person in 2015 was 4.3 times higher than in India. In addition, India's income and energy use per person are projected to remain lower than other major economies, even as we assume, in the reference case, the highest annual GDP growth rate of 6% between 2015 and 2040. The GDP per person is only projected to reach about $20,000 by 2040, about half that of China. And note that Africa is even lower and stays low despite our assumption of 3.8% growth per year. We believe the persistence of low energy consumption under high economic growth is an area worthy of more investigation. And now let's take a closer look at India. Again, we see the higher economic growth rate of 7.1% per year is the primary driver of energy consumption in all three cases, with the industrial sector in dark blue accounting for the majority of energy consumption. In the export-led case, delivered energy consumption increases the most, 33% above the reference case in 2040, because trade-sensitive energy-intensive industries produce more goods. In the investment-led case, delivered energy use is 29% higher because greater investment leads to higher output in a broader set of industries. And in the consumption-led case, energy use is only 26% higher than the reference case. As with China, the India results highlight the importance of changes in industrial sector demand. Now let's look at the per capita energy consumption from a different perspective. This slide indexes energy-intensive manufacturing output in China and India to a common starting point when the value of energy-intensive output was similar in both countries, 2000 for China and 2006 for India. The chart shows how quickly Chinese production in energy-intensive goods increased from 2000 to 2015. In India, the export-led case, which was the highest manufacturing output growth rate, India energy-intensive manufacturing output grows, but only reaches historic Chinese levels after 2035. This chart presents one of the more interesting insights from the from a different perspective, and we welcome the panel to make comments on this. Now, moving to Africa, where services are an even larger part of the economy. This slide shows that Africa's largest economies, representing nearly two-thirds of African GDP, will produce far more services than manufactured goods. This pattern continues for other smaller economies. For example, services account for 52% of the output in Cameroon and Kenya. Comparing total gross output for the reference case and the high growth case shows that services in yellow remains the largest component of the African economy, but decreases from 47 to 37%, while manufacturing in blue increases from 19 to 24% by 2040. This increase in manufacturing share coincides with an economy that is more urban, more effectively employs its population, and makes better use of natural resources. And as with India, the projection raises many questions for further study. Finally, as expected, Given its greater share of output, manufacturing energy consumption growth increases more than non-manufacturing by 2040, with industrial energy consumption more than 26% higher in the high economic growth case when compared to the reference case, and non-manufacturing energy consumption 23% higher. And so in conclusion, in examining the impact of high economic growth and varying economic development pathways on energy consumption for the rapidly growing economies of China, India, and Africa, we have shown that the primary drivers of energy use is economic growth and that pathways to growth modulate that energy consumption. We have also shown that despite growth per capita, energy consumption of Africa and India remain comparatively low, and this highlights the need to further explore the relationship between high economic growth, relative size of the services and manufacturing sectors, and energy consumption, which leads me to ask you, the audience, and the panel that will follow, what's surprising, what's expected, what are your insights, and what topics should we explore more deeply? EIA is going into a strategic planning session following this presentation, looking at where we want to be positioned in adding value in the IEO next year. And so we plan to make use of your comments and the comments of the panel to help inform us as to how we can provide data that's more impactful in understanding how these economies are moving. And with that, I want to thank you for your attention today. So for the Q&A, I want to introduce Vipin Arora, who is one of our researchers at the EIA, and we have many EIA members here who are experts on the topics much better than I am, who can field and answer your questions. So with that, I'll turn it over to Frank.
Thanks.
All right, so I'm going to open it up for questions before we invite our panelists up here. I have two quick questions, though. So one is on mission, and one is on policy focus. So EIA is one of the few places around where you can still get a reference case to compare things against. But increasingly, we all know that the reference case, it's not a forecast because things change, and the notion of the delta about what variables impact demand over 25 or 30 years is so large that I applaud the effort to drill down a little deeper and add more granularity. How difficult is that when you start looking at the quality of the data from some of these countries, what you choose to look at? You have to stress test your models now to see what is more impactful than something else as you go out 22 or 25 years.
So you're asking multiple questions. I'll start with the first one, is the reference case. EIA takes our role very seriously about presenting the data in a non-biased way. And we do not pick and choose policies. In the case of our annual energy outlook for the United States, we use only the policies that exist. So only rules that are enforced with their expiration dates. When we go internationally, that's much more difficult,
right,
because there are many stated intentions. And so we have to exercise some reasonableness, some reasonable care, as in the case of China, where there is a stated policy to reduce energy consumption. And so we see that the trend is following, that they are moving in that direction. And so we use some prudent estimates. But we have to always look at what our role is. Our role is to provide a foundation for the discussion of policy. And that means that if you look at a reference case and you don't like where it's going, then you need to do something. EIA is not going to do something about it. You need to do something about it. And so when we miss when our projections are missed, that means some actions were taken that were different than what we saw at the time that we wrote the document. And this is a very positive thing. It shows that policies are having an effect. And so the question that we have as we move internationally and get deeper into the issues there is, what is the best data that we should be presenting and aggregating, both in quality and in relevance to the debates that are going on and issues trying to be solved, and which is why we're very thankful that you're hosting the panel and some additional workshops over the next year.
Nice segue.
Yes, nice segue. Because that will help us understand what is being debated and where we can be the most useful.
And from a mechanical point of view, so the notion of multiple countries, multiple regions, variety of issues, some happen earlier in the cycle,
yes,
some happen later in the cycle, all are impactful. if you just take tariffs, trade, and barriers to globalization, it not only impacts country X, but all the regional countries around them.
And now it impacts the United States because of our exporting. One of the things we did in this IEO was we exercised the limits of the model. We pushed it to the boundary conditions. And part of that is to really understand, do we have enough variables in there? And that's part of what the discussions will be. As you saw, GDP right now is the dominant factor. We did not do a case. We did not do a case of at what point, how slow does GDP have to go where the pathway begins to be the dominating effect on energy consumption. But clearly, we need to understand, for example, will tariffs begin to have an effect? And we don't know how to incorporate that yet, but we'll be listening carefully and debating and having discussions around how the models can accept those kinds of variations. And I want to ask Vipin if there's someone else in EIA that might want to make a comment or add some insight into that.
I think I'll add a little bit. So as the administrator said, we pushed at least the macroeconomic portion of our modeling system pretty much to its limits. And what you find is you find strange results. All of you have done some modeling, you'll see some strange results at the edges there. And so you have to decide, well, is this something I expected to see? Am I missing something? Or, you know, is my model somehow screwing up? And so that's where I think some of the discussion today will be very helpful, and any comments that we get from the audience as well, I think will be really helpful.
Okay. All right, so let me do this. We have time. We'll take three basic questions on the overview, and then we'll invite the panelists up. We'll do a deeper dive on the countries and open it back up. So we only have a couple of quick rules when we do Q's and A's. I've got to move this podium. Q's and A's for sessions at CSIS. First is that you wait for the microphone. Second is you identify yourself, and to the extent that you can, pose your question in the form of a question. That's always helpful. If you've got a comment that's impactful to this analysis, we'd like to hear that as well. So, Jan. Your hand was up before I stood up.
Right. I'm Jan Maris, Resources for the Future. In your petroleum long-term world demand, I think you only gave the world. I don't think you gave OECD versus non-OECD. And what it shows is a rise out to the end. For the non-OECD, do you show a rise or do you show any peaking?
We, in terms of petroleum consumption you're talking about, Jan, yeah, we don't show peaking. We show a rise out through the projection period. I don't remember exactly the growth rate or how fast it is, but I can get you those numbers.
Okay. So we do show, I mean, if this is where we're going with the question, as I said in the presentation, that we see that all fuels are needed. Energy consumption, the world energy consumption increases sufficiently fast over the period that you're finding a pull at all fuels. And we also saw the uptick between 2030 and 2040, which we have not investigated more closely. But again, renewables and natural gas have rapid growth, but it's not enough to substitute for petroleum and other liquids, or to substitute substitute for coal completely or nuclear. And so we're still on a pathway, at least from our projections, to use all fuels, unless there are some major changes in energy consumption. And I'll just highlight, which we saw in industry, the fact that the per capita energy consumption stays low for Africa and India, despite rapid economic growth, is something we really have to look at. If that can be maintained, we can learn something from that. If it isn't maintained, it's going to put more stress and pull at the fuels more. And so I think that's an area which I know that I really want to have the panelists make comments on.
Far side and then come back towards the middle.
Hi, Patricia Loria from the Global Carbon Capture and Storage Institute. Are you going to talk about kind of emissions and what these projections are meaning for kind of global emissions of CO2?
We did not do CO2 emissions this year. So the answer is not in this IEO.
I have the same question.
Okay.
Same answer.
I have a very different question. Okay, my name is Mari Saita from New York University. So how do you see the impact of cryptocurrency and blockchain energy consumption?
I'm sorry, can you speak louder?
How do you see the impact of cryptocurrency and blockchain energy
blockchain.
Consumption?
Blockchain.
Yeah, we didn't look into that. I don't want to speculate. So yeah, we didn't look into the impact of one on the other.
On emissions.
On emissions, yeah, because after I answered, I realized that despite the fact that we did not do a calculation of CO2 emissions, indirectly you have that data when you look at how the fuel growth, and you're seeing the rapid increase of natural gas and renewables that will offset the petroleum, coal, and nuclear if they were to be used instead of natural gas and renewables. But I will say that, as I answered in the first part of this, that the growth for energy consumption is growing so fast that we're not seeing in our projections that you can substitute those fuels yet. And so if we either have to reduce our energy consumption or do something else around renewables if we're going to impact the CO2 emission. Okay. That's what the data shows.
So if you were to extend this out to 2050, I don't think people have I think increasingly they have a sensitivity to the investment timelines. So like 2030 for the energy industry is tomorrow.
Well, the reason why I commented about the uptick is if that uptick continues, there's an uptick between 2030 and 2040. If that continues out to 2050, right. Our policies are not on the policies are not having enough of an impact to bring that down. And the energy consumption trends are not enough to bring that down. That's why we highlight that uptick at 2030.
Would that be a side case possibility to look at an accelerated transformation for the U.S. like we start looking at it for other countries?
I think that's something we should consider for 2019 is what's going on in 2030 okay. that caused that. Was it the model? Is it an artifact
right,
of the model?
Exactly.
Is it the assumptions? Again, we pointed out that we pushed the model to its limits. And so that we could highlight some of these kinds of inflection points. And so we plan to be asking this question over the coming months as to what we could examine that would help give better insight into that. And again, the purpose is to create a foundation so that people can focus on policies or practices or changes that will change that outcome, because that is
That's
something
your role.
That, yeah.
yeah. Okay. Let me take one other question. Right here.
Hello, good morning. My name is Padu Padmanabhan, and I was the ex-director for South Asia Energy with USAID in New Delhi.
Okay.
And I'm going to follow as a cue the last four points that you made.
Thank you.
And I'll talk a little bit on India. It's more of a comment than anything else. I'm not at all surprised. As a matter of fact, if India were to follow an export-oriented strategy, what's happening now with Make in India under the President Modi government, obviously the industrial sector is going to be a major consumer of both energy and water. And both these resources are hugely stressed at this point in time. And given the inefficiencies of water use in industry, as well as in agriculture, but let's focus on industry for a moment, the penalties on the energy side are also great. Both the energy and water sector don't talk to one another. They're like ships passing silently in the night. And I would imagine that a program to optimize water use would have a huge impact on energy use and would bump down the growth rate of energy in the industrial sector. So among the various topics which came up in my mind, I thought this was an important one. Thank
Interesting.
You.
Okay, I look forward to it. Look yeah. for you after the break.
Yeah, I was going to say, perfect insight. This is exactly yeah. what we're looking for. Let me switch a little bit. So I'm going to invite the panelists up, because as we add granularity to this discussion, it may trigger some additional questions. So if you can come up and join us. Linda, you can stay.
I'm going to move over here.
Okay. So joining us for this discussion are Todd Moss. Todd's a senior fellow at the Center for Global Development where his research focus has been on U.S.-Africa relations, energy policy, and investment. He's also a former Deputy Assistant Secretary of State for African Affairs. On my immediate left is Anvita Arora from CAPSARC. So Adam sent her with his best wishes to come see us. Lori did not send us baked goods, and we are not sending back chocolate to Adam until he shows up. Anvita is an architect and transport planner, and before joining CAPSARC, she was managing director and CEO of Innovative Transport Solutions, an incubator company at IIT in Delhi. And then our own Ed Chow. So Ed is a senior fellow here with the Energy and National Security Program. He's an international energy expert in every sense of the word. I've known Ed for probably 30 years. He was stationed in Asia, the Middle East, Africa, Europe, South America, Russia, and the Caspian. For 20 years, he served with Chevron, serving in both regional assignments as well as head of external international relations. So this is a terrific panel, and they're here to provide insights, remarks, questions, and suggestions for how we can go forward for the next iteration of the IEO. And India, I'm going to start with you. Okay? Go ahead.
I think, like Padu said, I'm not surprised.
I think we have to get your mic on.
My mic on?
It should be. Is it green? Okay.
It's green.
It's not working. Okay.
Okay. So, like Padu had pointed out earlier, I'm not surprised at all. Yes, as we are growing, we will consume more energy. But there are a few things that we would like to flag. India's energy consumption pathway.
Okay, it should be working now.
Okay. Is that better? Yeah. India's energy consumption pathway now and in the future is quite unique. It is very difficult to compare it to China or South Korea or the US. And there are many, many reasons for that. Let's start with something as simple as temperatures. We don't have any heating load at all. You can hear me now. Yeah. So just to reiterate that we have a very different way of energy consumption in the country. It starts with temperatures. We don't have heating loads. We have very little air conditioning. And as we are growing and urbanizing and the energy consumption may change, the adoption of the newest and the latest energy efficient gadgets is very much on the anvil. I think the second thing is that economy has been informal, right? It is not a government-led or government-supported economy. And I'm talking of 60-70% of the economic, the engagement is at an informal level, not counted for. And the informal economies have been extremely efficient in terms of its energy consumption. And we are moving from what was an informal economy, bypassing a lot of government investment kind of stuff, and moving into a more private investment, market-led, entrepreneurship-based economy, which is also going to be very energy efficient. Markets don't like to waste stuff. So I think we have the opportunity to leapfrog from a traditional energy efficient past to a modernized energy efficient future, kind of bypassing a lot of wastage that may happen in a higher consumption led pathway that may happen. And so these are a couple of things I wanted to point out. And the third thing is that the Internet of Things is a great equalizer. It is very difficult to discount the fact that India, because of the extreme penetration of the smartphones, the availability of data practically for free, even at the rural level, we find that a lot of, it's hard to say that India today would be like China or US 10 years back or 15 years back or even 5 years back. Because there are so many, the internet brings in things, and the way the millennials are consuming energy is completely different all over the world. So I think there are a few things that would be interesting to look at in the unique pathway that India is at.
Can I ask you one quick question on that? So data collection and reliability of data in an informal economy,
yeah.
Confidence level, that there's good data? Are we going to be surprised 3 years out when there's more and better collection that all of a sudden things spike because there's changes in the way people are using energy?
To some extent, yes, but also if we start looking at energy consumption more sectorally, I'm a transport planner, so it's right. You know, that's something that I would look at, is that when you start looking at how people are moving in cities, and we have data on that, so you use that data to corroborate energy consumption data, and you find that 25 to 50% people in most cities are actually walking to work, walking to, you know. So that data is pretty reliable. The fact that the mode share of public transport is anything between 20 to 35% in most cities, the fact that car usage in terms of the mode share is something like 2 to 10%. Small. Depending on cities, so it's small. So once you start looking at other sectors and look at that data to corroborate the energy data, I think we can do some kind of validation exercise.
And that's exactly what I think, Linda, you're looking for in this exercise,
yes,
is
exactly.
why things are as they seem to be,
yeah.
right? What factors are influencing that. Yeah. Todd, let me ask you about Africa, which is a little bit different since it's a continent, not a country, and has a variety of different producers, consumers, different economic development, geographic location, ethnic groups.
Yeah, so
how do you break down Africa?
Let me make a couple points on the report and then a couple of policy,
yes,
policy points. The first is, as the slide suggested, you know, we're talking about 54 countries. You really want to disaggregate that because some of these economies are really taking off in exciting ways and some economies are not. They're really quite stagnant, and when you aggregate everything, you lose a lot of the, there's a lot of action going on in African economies and in the energy sector, and when you aggregate everything, you lose a lot of that action. The other is that you notice just six countries accounted for two-thirds of GDP. That means there's 48 countries in the bottom third, and actually that group of 48 countries has a lot of dynamism. So you really want to just not look at essentially South Africa, Egypt, and Nigeria, and then everybody else. You actually want to look at some of the economies where the opportunities, particularly in the energy sector, actually exist. From a pure data point of view, if you're going to show Africa on a graph with global energy, because Africa's starting from such a low base, you got to log your figures, and that'll show you some of the disaggregation there. So that's my first point. I think everybody would get that. The second is I want to applaud the report for really focusing on industrial use. I've been working on energy sector in Africa for a while, and the discussion is almost entirely about access. Mm-hmm. It's about how do we get basic electricity into households, which is really important. If you are cooking with wood and getting your heating and lighting from kerosene, obviously getting the first light bulb in your house is really important, but the relationship of how energy drives economic growth and future prosperity is energy for industrial and commercial use, not for household consumption. And so I think that's really important to keep that focus. And then the third point on the report is it's very positive to highlight these massive gaps that we're talking about. When you're just talking about global BTUs, it gets a little lost. I like to think about it a little bit more concretely. So one example is that in the United States, we have about 8,000 power plants in this country, about 8,000. Liberia, a country in West Africa of about 4 million people, has total electricity capacity less than one average U.S. power plant. So Liberia has less than one of our 8,000 power plants electricity. That is the gap that we're talking about. The other way, I work mostly in the power sector, so I think in kilowatt hours, if you think about the relationship between electricity consumption and income growth, there is no such thing in the world as a rich country that doesn't consume a ton of electricity. In fact, there are no high income countries in the world where per capita electricity consumption is below 5,000 kilowatt hours. In the US, we're about 13,000. Nigeria, big African economy, 150. So they want to get rich, All countries want to be high income. If they want it, they have to get their energy consumption not from 150 to 300 or 500, but up over 3,000, 5,000. And just to give you a comparison, Nigeria is only 150. Your refrigerator, my refrigerator, uses about 400 a year. So just the basic appliances that we take for granted use more electricity than the average person in most countries. So then just three quick points on policy. And this is particularly relevant because we have an important US initiative called Power Africa, which this administration is continuing, which is promoting electrification in Africa. And I think it's very important that we don't set a double standard for Africa versus the rest of the world. And the first is that energy is about jobs. It's not about home lighting. In Africa, there are 12 million young people that join the job market every year. And energy is among the very, very top constraints to job creation. Nigeria, very important country. Nigeria is going to have a larger population than the United States by around 2040, 2043, larger than the United States. They have less than 1% of our electricity capacity. So we really need to think in orders of magnitude. Second policy point, and this gets to EIA, is that using data rather than ideology can really help us to avoid being hypocrites with our policy. So power is absolutely essential to modern living, to modern economies. It's embedded in everything. So when we talk about economies leapfrogging, that's very important. Yes, new technologies. Yes, these markets will build their energy systems in different ways than we did or Europe did. But we need to be very careful when we talk about leapfrogging. I have never given a talk about energy in Africa and somebody hasn't talked about the cell phone revolution and what can we learn about skipping landlines. Well, the cell phones actually provide a very important lesson. That lesson is that while you can charge your cell phone with a single solar panel, and you can leapfrog charging your cell phone, for a smartphone to actually function, to manufacture, to run the towers, and to run the data center so that thing functions, you need a high energy, reliable power system. And more than 99% of the power that allows your smartphone to function is not in the charging. So we need to be careful about leapfrogging. And I think it's also worth remembering that these lights that we're sitting in an air-conditioned building right now in Washington, D.C., where a lot of these decisions are made, 95% of the power in Washington, D.C. comes from coal, gas, and nuclear. 95%. I often get reminded of that fact by my African colleagues when we start talking about, oh, you should really, you know, don't avoid those technologies. You should only use newer technologies. So, well, what do you do in Washington, D.C.? And then that leads to my final point, which is, what about climate change? I'm glad we got the questions about emissions. And what does climate change mean for African economies? If we think about the agenda for resilience and adaptation, what does that mean for Africa? It means a ton more concrete and steel. There is a lot of construction coming. What does it mean if the climate is going to be drier? It means they're going to need a lot more powered irrigation. They're going to need a lot of desalinization. What does a hotter climate mean? It means there's going to be a lot more cold storage and a lot more use of air conditioning. And of course, all of these technologies are incredibly energy intensive. So climate change, if anything, should be raising the bar of what kind of energy demand we would expect from Africa.
Well, and it also speaks to this issue of the timing of investment, what's going to be needed to be put in place so that the next level effects can develop, right?
Absolutely, so. Absolutely.
Okay. Ed, we saved the last piece for you. So you can talk a bit about China, and then we'll kind of tie them all together and look for other insights.
Well, thanks, Frank. I have been asked to talk about China, so of course I'm going to start with a general comment. It's related to China. I just wonder, with the first slide, Linda, at what point the energy analytical modeling community is going to stop using OECD, non-OECD, right, as a destination. When non-OECD, at the end of the forecast period, it will be two-thirds of total global energy consumption. And this is somewhat related to China, because China has been the biggest thing that's happened in the global energy scene the last 10, 15, maybe even 20 years. I tease my Chinese friends, at what point is your country actually emerged, as opposed to emerging, when you've been the elephant in the room for so long. I think it is particularly relevant to a point asked about what surprised me in the forecast. If I read the China slides and texts that were provided to us beforehand, you actually have Chinese energy efficiency improvement or Chinese energy intensity lower than OECD average by the end of the period. So at what point do we need a different classification, mm-hmm, of these economies around the world than traditional one, which has been convenient? I understand the reason for it, but I think at some point it becomes obsolete. Another big takeaway from the report, it seems to me, is how much GDP drives everything. As Linda said, that the transition to a consumer economy modulates but doesn't determine
the
services economy, yeah, modulates, but it's really GDP growth that drives total energy consumption. Now, on that, the GDP growth assumption is interesting to me. You have two different cases, a base case of 4.5 and a higher case of 5.7% GDP growth. And I know you're doing modeling, you have to do it for generalized over a long period of time. But do note that that is lower than the official forecast for the current five-year plan, which of course is a political document. The current five-year plan, as far as I can tell, has a 6.5% GDP growth, mainly so that Xi Jinping can reach the goal that he has set for 2021 in terms of Chinese people's standard of living, having to do with the 100th anniversary of the founding of the Chinese Communist Party. If that wasn't a political objective as opposed to an economic forecast, I don't know what is. But nevertheless, it's lower than the Chinese themselves forecast for the next 5 years. It's lower than history. It would be interesting, I think, for us to understand whether you see that as a glide path of some sort, that you start with, let's say, 6%, and then gradually go down over the forecast period so that you reach an average of whether it's 5.7 or 4.5%, because I think that would be meaningful, mm-hmm, in terms of the energy numbers we get in the end. Another comment in terms of what policymakers may be interested in as you drill down more deeply into the forecast is what the fuel mix is going to be for China. I mean, I think that, you know, that's a huge question. Obviously, if the energy demand growth is supplied mainly by nuclear and renewables, you come up with one emission scenario. If it's supplied by fossil fuels, it's a different scenario. I think particularly for the industry, it'd be really interesting to know what the role of gas is going to be in China, for China in the future. Even with the recent growth in gas, China lags behind the world average in terms of natural gas as a percentage of primary energy by quite a bit. I mean, I think China's probably about 7% right now. Gas as a percentage of primary energy consumption will average closer to 20. So, and they have very ambitious plans on doubling and increasing their natural gas growth. But where is that going to come from on the supply side? Now, is it going to be domestic production, which they also have very ambitious plans for, or is it going to be imported gas? And if it's imported gas, is that going to be LNG, or is it going to be pipeline gas from Central Asia and Russia? The reason to ask the question is one wonders, given particularly given the recent, the last year or so, increase in LNG imports in China, whether we're going to repeat the experience we had with oil, where Chinese oil consumption drove the world market. I mean, for a dozen years, China's oil demand growth represented something around close to half of global growth. Well, are we going to have a repeat of that in terms of gas or not? Or something else going to happen? I think those would be interesting questions to look into in the future, whether it's part of a country study or part of a IEO. I think China is going through very different transition today than either Africa or India. I mean, look at the demography, for example. Demography by itself is going to drive towards more of a services sector growth, it seems to me. But then there's also what the Chinese are doing on automation and AI. That may also affect future Chinese energy demand growth. So I left you a lot of food for thought, but with lots of questions, but no good answers.
Well, and I think, so there's a couple of common themes. So part of it is when you stress test the models, as we've talked about, whether or not the assumptions, the old proxies that we used to have on GDP, population growth, as different kind of economies transition to service export-led, what kind of investment, what their neighbors are doing, what the role of technology is, what your choices are, whether you're walking, riding a bicycle, or driving a car, and what your fuel choices are that are available, we need to come up with a new set of variables and weighting so that these models have accuracy even at 5 years. So part of it is when we look at the transition, the where's Waldo moment, right? So what would you look for, and I'll start and go down the line, what would you look for to tell you that a change is taking place, the most impactful type of change? When you look at India and the work that you do at CAPSAR, so what's the significant variable that you think will outweigh some of the others, and when you look, that's your aha moment for figuring out where demand is going to be in the next 5 years, not even the next 30?
I think when we are looking at the work that we are doing in CAPSAC and looking at the way India is going, one of the things to look at is what are the current policies in India.
Okay.
So for example, the smart cities investment that is happening, how is it figured out? We had before this 7 years of really infrastructural investment. So let us build cities which are infrastructure led, right? So that was a different time. Now with the Modi government, smart cities investment, it is not so much about infrastructure as it is about systems, as it is about private players coming in, as it is about convergence, using technology to create efficiencies. So it is more looking at that we've had these forecasts, these different models, and what are they saying, but to start wetting it against what are the ambitions of the government now. Energy security is a huge concern for the country. We are importing all our energy. So energy security is a huge concern. How will it drive policies in the future? And it would be interesting to look at if the three cases that have been developed in EIA, which are the ones which are most aligned to the ground reality of Indian policy scenarios. And for us, that would be an interesting narrative to look at, whether it is urbanization through a smart cities kind of an idea, whether it is the make in India investment in creating self-sufficiency and more export-led thing, whether it is the whole aspiration of a generation to be more in the services sector and white-collar jobs rather than blue-collar, will it create industries or not? So there are all these things that are happening on the ground and at the policy levels, which we should start, you know, kind of looking at that and validating it against what are our energy projection demand. And hence, because these will drive, like you said, modes that you use, fuel choices, investments in renewables, uptake of whether electric vehicles are going to come or not, considering that even the houses, you know, a lot of the rural areas are not electrified fully. Do we have electricity available for vehicles? So a lot of these questions, I think, are interesting to look at vis-a-vis the larger macroeconomic energy scenario.
And Linda, I think we're developing a greater appreciation for the work that you do, the complexity.
Yeah.
Going back a few years, and one of the Petroleum Council studies, we have put together a format for how you look at energy, and it was the, you know, a triangle or a Venn diagram that looked at energy security, foreign policy, environment, and economic growth.
Yeah.
And your choices are trade-offs on how you get there. But then the second piece of that is when you start looking at changes that are actually occurring, and you talk about resiliency of the system. If you're wrong on your policy projections that are driving it, and they don't come to fruition in time, your energy demand is way out of sync with what your capability is, which creates other vulnerabilities.
Yeah.
And Todd, we've seen that in Africa in spades. So can you tell us what you'd be looking for?
Yeah, look, I think one is that, you know, it's very difficult to predict what's going to happen absent transparency about the cost assumptions, right? It's going to be costs that's going to drive people to switch fuels. It's going to be the pricing policy. You know, Nigeria is still flaring gas at the same time they are importing. You know, they have domestic electricity shortages. Forget going out 2040. In 5 years' time, what's the natural gas price going to look like? What's the Nigerian pricing policy going to be on gas? I have no idea, and I don't think anybody can tell you what that is. But those are the policies that are going to be determining, you know, a lot of the fuel mix in a market like that. And that's why, you know, you want to be careful about that. The other thing I would say is that the IMF. They do a good job at short-term projections, long-term projections. They have structural optimism built into their projections, and in part that's because they're looking for lower debt loads in the future so that countries can assume higher, you know, they can take on greater borrowing. And there is a very, very significant structural optimism built into that, and it gets worse the further out that you go.
Ed, thoughts on it?
I was interested in one of Linda's slides on China on construction. I really think at what point is China kind of saturated the domestic market for construction? There are articles just in the last couple of days about construction housing. You know, at what point is China built out, and you're now talking about renovation of housing as opposed to new construction altogether? You could think of Belt and Road policy as a way of exporting your surplus industrial and construction capacity. But it looks like both urbanization in China is coming closer to the end than we certainly would have thought 20 years ago. Now, I don't know where the break's going to be, but I think that would be one of the things that would drive the domestic Chinese economy quite a bit. And that and the demographic trend going forward, I think it's going to be huge.
Well, and just like in the oil industry, when we do simulation and compare it against actual, right, in like real time and make changes, we're on a faster track now, whether it's with blockchain or data or the fact that this information is more readily available. Linda, you have some thoughts that you want to share?
I think the points that you're bringing out, you know, in a lot of the presentation, we were presenting cumulative. But really, when you're doing modeling, you're looking at the inflection points where one trend rolls away and another trend becomes more dominant. And this has been very helpful in, you know, in helping us think about where to focus and to then look where the signposts are that these transitions are going to occur. And if something else that we didn't think about is going to come up behind us very quickly and take over, as you were pointing out in Africa, there's a lot of variables that we weren't looking at. So this is, again, a very helpful beginning of looking at our IEO 2019 and what we want to focus on then.
All right, so we have a lot of brain power in the audience, and I'm going to start there. Ben, why don't you pick up it?
Thank you so much, Frank. Wow, compliments to the panel. You've all done really, really well. Linda, this was extremely interesting. I'm Ben Schlesinger. I focus on natural gas. I think everybody's now focusing on natural gas. And picking up on your comments, what goes wrong in the forecasts of natural gas, as I think back over, you know, the decades I've been dealing with this, is technology. It's technological change and how it adjusts and readjusts costs. I came into this business, you know, as a kid, I guess, thinking that this was an engineering problem, basically. Spent many years and decades in this place realizing, of course, it's a political and, you know, other things going on. But I kind of come back to my technology roots. When we look at AEO forecasts, the only forecast that consistently hits the numbers right is the high resource and technology case. Do you have any, so, you know, and then picking up on Ed's thoughts, technology would change the balance of fuels used in China, coal versus gas. If you're putting in gas with 60%, 70% efficiency turbines, you know, clearly that's going to make a difference. So energy efficiency plays deeply into this as well. In Africa, you know, the LNG, you know, gas to power is kind of driving what seems to be, you know, going on, but technology is creating some choices, and the pace of technology change in creating cost changes is scary. No, it's exciting, and, you know, welcome it. So that would be my suggestion, to try to bring out the tech, maybe have a high technology and resource case.
Well, and the timing, just to kind of two-finger Ben's point, the timing on investments, once they're put in place, it's hard to walk away from them. So if new investments are made and technology is right around the corner, but you miss that initial curve and have to wait for the second wave, then you're stuck in a lot of places with what you have. And we can walk away from infrastructure we haven't in the past.
So. And as you're talking about infrastructure, you were mentioning construction. As you start investing in infrastructure, you start to lock down.
Yeah.
And we just, you know, that's an area of, especially in these high growth modeling, you know, what infrastructure do you pick and when do you start investing in it and how's that going to affect the long term? That's definitely an area that needs to be looked at.
Well, I don't want to beat the emissions horse too much, but the notion of a lot of the population growth is on the coastal areas.
Yes.
If we're actually going to see an increase in coastal flooding, maybe that's not a good place to be putting billions of people. Okay. Other questions, comments? Todd,
comments on that question?
Yeah, sure.
Gather?
Do you have a technology?
Well, I think on the technology, it's in particular markets, definitely in sub-Saharan Africa, there are some international policy issues that actually have quite a big impact because a lot of countries, they borrow not from the private market so much, but they borrow from multilateral development banks.
There you go.
And investors might be looking for tools like EXIM or OPIC to cover some of the political risk in these markets. And this is in an environment where other countries are making different policy choices. I'll just take an extreme case. Russia is actively promoting small modular reactors, nuclear reactors, in Africa. The United States does not support export of our small modular sector. So countries that might have a choice between, say, you know, EXIM is barely functioning, might have a choice between, say, a GE gas turbine or an American nuclear technology, are going to choose Russian modular reactors because the Russians are providing finance that the US has decided not to do. So I do think a lot of those choices can be made in capitals and can have quite big repercussions without sort of realizing that is deeply affecting the policy choices that countries are making that's going to have a 20, 30, 40 year echo effect.
Ed, Linda, you want to talk about technology and maybe, Linda, how you plan to integrate that into your planning?
Stay tuned. Do you have any comments with them?
Comments, but let me turn it over to our chief modeler who can probably talk a little bit about that. in terms of technology.
Oh, man. You're just baiting me, Vipin. Come on, man. Okay, so let me
Introduce yourself first, David.
So I'm David Daniels. I'm the Chief Energy Modeler of EIA. This is a fantastic panel. Thank you very much for your comments. I really appreciate them. But I desperately wanted to push back, and Vipin could tell, on the panel. So can I ask Frank's question again? Because it was a great question, and both Anvita and Todd, you both skipped the question. So let me ask it again. Frank asked, what are the indicators of future change? And you both answered policy. And I get it, because policy is going to absolutely drive the energy system going forward. But that wasn't his question. His question was, what are the indicators of that? There's an awful lot of policy in the world that doesn't drive the energy system. There's a lot of stated policies that never actually become binding, right? So yes, some of the policies do drive the energy system. And one could argue that going forward, where maybe, you know, economics is always there, policy is becoming more and more important in how we think about how the energy system evolves. But is that the best indicator? I once heard, this is not David Daniels speaking, I'm going to just echo somebody else. I once heard a Wall Street analyst actually saying, if you want to look at India and China and what's going to happen in those countries, you know, China has a five-year plan. And if it's in China's five-year plan, you can take it to the bank that it's going to happen. India also has a five-year plan. And if it's in India's five-year plan, you can take it to the bank that it's not going to happen, right? So yes, policy drives the energy system. But what's the best indicator of that? And then, you know, Todd, you mentioned investment. Should we be looking at policies? Right. Should we be looking at investments? Should we be looking at something else, some indicator? What's the tripwire that we should be looking at to figure out?
So, for example, if the nuclear power plants start getting built, that's the indicator that they're going to that energy. What technology investments or what investments in infrastructure will start to, yeah.
Nice job. Nice communication.
Well, and even on the gas side, right? So, I mean, one of the things, and Ed and I talk about this all the time, if there's a new form of gas contract that diverges from what we've done in the past, does that make things happen quicker with a different group of people that otherwise wouldn't be available to finance a new regasification facility or liquefaction facility, right? We're thinking with kind of the old modeling and the old infrastructure, but things are changing really quickly. Ed, you get your two fingers.
I just thought I'd respond to David's question while the others think about the answers. I think a old indicator that we all kind of missed is what China air quality did to policy. I mean, we all saw it. Every time you land in Beijing, you saw it, right? You saw the air. You can actually touch it. But what we just didn't quite understand the tipping point that it made into the politics of the country to drove the policy after a documentary was made and so on. So we all saw the signs, but we didn't understand it. In hindsight, we didn't understand it was as significant as it was. And we have now seen the huge increase in LNG imports in the last year and two as a direct result of that indicator that we should have noticed better, it seems to me. I've been wondering for a long time whether Chinese oil and gas import dependency would be a policy driver at some point for China. I mean, if we thought we had an oil dependency problem in the past, China has a much bigger oil dependency, import dependency problem, and their imports come from far away places. Our imports came from Western Hemisphere, by and large, closer by areas. And now they're kind of doubling down from oil import dependency to increasingly, if we projections are correct into the future, gas import dependency as well. Well, how are they going to manage that? Is that going to have a foreign policy impact, or is it going to have an energy planning impact at some point? I think that's something that bears watching as that import dependency, according to everyone's projection, continues to grow in the next 2-3 years. Are they going to change their pathway that they've designed for themselves as a result of noticing this vulnerability that they have. I mean, I think that's something more for Chinese policymakers than Washington policymakers, but it's something for us to watch as well.
Well, and we do a lot of the geopolitics work here, and on the oil side, we've been seeing some of this. This is your early indicator. So the notion that a producer and a consumer would joint venture to build a refinery, Saudi Arabia and China, to run Saudi oil with a market, right? Do you start seeing regionalization? I see Lynn in the back, but this notion of product exports versus crude export. If you lose your refineries and you're product dependent, you're more secure, you're less secure. Is that a national security facility or industry? What about natural gas? What about promoting alternatives and getting away from that dependency? So there's a lot that starts factoring into things that we always knew about, but the implications weren't as far-reaching or as quickly noticed before. But you wanted to make a comment.
Yeah, I just wanted to build up on what Ed said and something Linda had said earlier to try to frame the answer to your question. And I want to give the example of coal. So India has made a huge investment in assets, and there are banks which have lent, to have more electricity generation by coal. However, air pollution becoming such a huge issue.
Delhi is worse than Beijing.
Yeah, it's worse than Beijing, and it is not only Delhi, and there are many other cities which are being affected by it, severe congestion, etc. I think we are at that cusp where maybe, at some point of some time earlier, those asset investment would have been the driver of the energy choice. But now the whole pushback against this emissions and the fact that quality of life is suffering and people are dying and children are dying, the health impacts, those are also becoming huge policy drivers. So I cannot answer the question whether it is the investment in coal that will be the driving choice or whether it is going to be the policy. But my gut feeling on this is not only air pollution, but the fact that it ties up so well in the climate change and the health and all that, that we may be in a position where in spite of our poverty, we may be willing to lose the assets we've created on coal and still focus on renewables, So, in terms of getting indicators, I think if we want to have indicators, we may have to start looking at it more sectorally, right? If I come as a transportation planner, it is easier for me to give you a set of indicators and say that, if you look at the mode shares, you look at the way investment in public transport is happening, you look at the way how cities under 100 cities under the Smart Cities program are saying, let's build cycle track and public bike share systems because we don't have any more space. You look at the percentage of area which is devoted to parking and how that is changing. Those may be the drivers of energy choices in transportation. So indicators, if you have to start building in indicators, we'll have to start thinking sectorally. It is tougher to have indicators which are macroeconomic and because then you don't know what is it that is driving that particular choice.
So, David, it's good of you to push us. Look, I think in general, focusing on GDP, that is good, that is the indicator. That is, if that's the strongest correlation you're going to find, you're right to have that at the heart of your model. The problem, you've got an endogeneity problem, though, which is that energy is driven by GDP. Well, GDP is also driven by energy. What's the difference in that gap there? A lot of that is going to be determined by policy. Why is Nigeria so far under the curve? They consume 80% less energy than they should given their income level. How do we get Nigeria first up to where they should be given their income level? And then how is that gonna drive future GDP growth over 10, 20 years, which is then gonna further drive energy consumption in both the consumer and in the industrial sector? So this is I guess why we're falling back on policy, that you're seeing that driving some of the gaps. And then that can either be an upward spiral or downward spiral.
Okay. Other thoughts?
We just triggered something else in your mind.
Yeah, nobody mentioned cars, and transportation. You did.
Absolutely,
you did. But it hadn't really come out. So it's one of the technology pieces that's changing rapidly. And I know China's outproducing everyone in electric cars. By far at this point. And so it's about 1% of sales, maybe 2%. At what point you know, how's the model taken, maybe, you know, the percentage of electric cars sold is a kind of an indicator, or the cost of an electric car relative to a gasoline car. Oil markets, the extent to which oil markets are based in transportation, or a more broad range of markets, you know, oil sales. And I wouldn't mention LNG either, whether natural gas costs, you know, how that changes the balance of natural gas costs relative to other options, for example, in Africa. As I mentioned, we spend a lot of time on gas in Africa. We spend a lot of time on Nigeria, you know, 230 flared wells. Just no only way to catch them seems to be, you know, through small-scale LNG, which the Russians are also pushing in addition to
domestic news.
Small-scale nuclear. So just some additional thoughts. These are the things I look for, you know, in evaluating the model. It was great. The presentation is great from the top down. But in the deep dive, you know, we really look for, you know, for example, U.S. exports. Is that a realistic number, whatever the number is?
Can I say something
sure.
about that? As a transport planner,
yeah,
I can't
absolutely.
Stop. So I think this whole thing of focus on cars is also very much a US and OECD country issue. Because if you look at Africa and India, maybe I won't say anything about Africa, we have an expert sitting here, but mobility is a big problem. It's not about cars, it's about moving people. And cars have a relatively small share in mobility. And I'll give you an example, electric vehicles specifically. India, a few months back, made a big statement that we will have all electric cars by 2030, and we rolled back on it. We rolled back on it primarily because if we have to look at electrification in mobility, we look at buses. You know, let's have electric buses, we'll look at electric auto rickshaws, tuk-tuks, we'll look at electric taxis. These things are easier to control by policy and carry a far larger number of people. Cars carry very few people. And then what about two-wheelers? You know, so cars are a very small part of the mobility story. I'm just saying, you know.
But those of us who spent a lot of time on the third ring in Beijing know that China is basically building parking lots.
So we digress.
Look, I think, you know, the structure of the economies are very different in different places. Consumer patterns tend to be relatively similar. When people hit a certain income level, they start to buy the same consumption goods. They start to buy a refrigerator, an air conditioner. They buy an automobile. They buy a computer. That I think is relatively, unless you're talking about very dense areas, you're going to still see those similar patterns. And India's a little bit further behind than China on that consumer consumption curve. Africa, the big African markets are even further behind. But when, you know, if you look, there was an IEA report of about a month ago looking at the demand for air conditioners. I don't remember the exact numbers, but they were mind-blowing. The number of people that are moving in, that are gaining enough income to start to buy their first air conditioner. Almost all of them live in really hot tropical climates that are getting hotter. That demand is gonna spike everything. So those are the kinds of things I look for.
Yeah, we're reminded of the summer burn every year in Saudi Arabia on air conditioning use.
I would caution the purchase of equipment as necessarily a good indicator of Chinese demand. I mean, it really, I think the demand figures themselves are a better indicator because people buy things in China in order to say that I have something, I have a car. I've risen to a level of standard of living that I'm entitled to a car, I buy a car. I have air conditioner. Doesn't mean that they turn it on all the time or they drive the same way we drive. Right, so I really think that at least for China that we need to be careful about these numbers. The Chinese are building a lot of electric cars. It's not very appealing at the consumer level. They're highly subsidized, and people buy them because that's the only way you win the lottery to have the right to own a car in urban cities. not because they prefer a EV car over internal combustion engine car. So I think the fact that people in increasingly a consumer society purchase things may or may not indicate totally the energy demand increase. It's related, of course. They will drive the car on the weekend to take the kids to the country or whatever. But whether they commute versus mobility by taking the metro, I mean, I was living in Beijing when they built the fourth ring road. For the Asian Games. And it was a mistake to build all those ring roads and not build metros earlier, because they adopted a different model of development. They thought that was what they were emulating, and that's what they did. It turned out to be a big mistake for the city of Beijing. You know, just be a little bit careful, cautious, I would say, in looking at Chinese buying hardware. I lived in a flat in Hong Kong growing up as a kid. Every room had a unit air conditioner. My mother's room was the only one where the air conditioner was allowed to be turned on by my parents. So we looked at the air conditioning.
And Ed's still going to therapy.
I'm still upset about that. Yes.
Well, and that brings us full circle to, you know, EIA. You know, we have multiple pillars of focus. You know, everyone's very familiar with our oil and gas pillar, which has been very well established, and we are very much focusing on electricity also, and working very hard to bring that to the same level of impact as oil and gas, but consumption. And we have been looking at consumption in the United States, and we need to be looking at consumption internationally. It's a very difficult area to sample and survey statistically. And it's also very difficult to get at the data, because it tends to be very disaggregated. It's not gathered in large groups. But some of the trends you're talking about, we even see in the US, where people don't use their dishwasher. You know, but they have them in every house. And so understanding the pull on energy, the consumption, is really, in my mind, a very important piece of the data that we at EIA need to be getting at. And we will continue to look for ways to do that.
Can I ask you, Linda, mechanically, so now that you've started down this road of, you know, disaggregation and deeper dives, which I think everyone applauds, what's the systematic way of going about soliciting
changing? That's why I alluded to the fact that we are going into strategic planning exercises. Exercises are different than a strategic plan. A strategic plan is a very broad swath. What we're doing is breaking down into these important areas and trying to understand how to have the most impact. And we are using the variable of impact, bringing the data forward in a way that's the most impactful on decisions on the energy consumer, whoever is using the energy data, to be able to make decisions in some way. That's industry, it's policy, it's anything. And so these exercises, as we come out of them, we'll begin to adjust our products, our reports, to reflect that. And consumption is a big piece of that, as is electricity, as is emergency preparedness, because that's grid reliability. There's many numbers. So stay tuned. And we are, like I said, bringing this panel together as part of the IEO is part of our method for outreach and trying to get data in, as will be workshops that will be happening over the coming year.
If folks want to submit ideas or suggestions, is there a specific site on the EIA website or a place where they can go?
Well, what you'll see is we do have a Office of Communications that is on the website, though, so that when you make inquiries, you'll see in different areas different people to contact, either the researchers directly or our Office of Communications. Again, the website's very clear on how to do that, and we'll just continue to gather information.
Okay. We have one more question back here.
Hello, Mr. Moss. My name is Steve Petrello. I'm a policy advisor with USDA Rural Utility Services. And you'd mentioned about, I guess, the primacy of what is the driver of infrastructure, energy infrastructure. I'd absolutely believe that it's most likely, obviously, the policy issue, but specifically, it would be the deeming, like, for instance, in our country, we've deemed energy a public utility, which means it is it's a free-to-reign monopoly specifically to guarantee the stakeholders have economies of scale in the infrastructure when they design the infrastructure, so there's no risk of threat that there'll be failure. Now, we need energy for jobs and living. A lot of these countries in Africa you mentioned are going to need, they may want to integrate, but they have to feel if they want to be a public utility and then figure out who the stakeholder is. So when you're saying that Russia wants to integrate and go into some of these places, you have to look at, well, okay, as you're saying, ma'am, the pool, like, what are you going to do? Is it, if you build it, will it come situation? Do these countries, are they ready to embrace this? Certain places in India, what you're seeing right now, or India, for instance, is investing in Afghanistan and with the dam building on the Indus River. But who are they going to sell it to? So my question is, it's more of a, if they build it, will they come, will they consume, will the jobs be there? Do you see this? And also, too, the other situation is with energy, you're going to have jobs. Are you going to have these kind of, this infrastructure, is this going to be modern kind of energy infrastructure, or is it going to be a huge carbon imprint on the country and on the planet as well? Are you using the best kind of, most kind of energy efficient for these developing energy infrastructure countries?
So, look, when if you're looking at a large-scale capital expenditure, you have to have a long-term contract with a creditworthy customer. In most places, that's a public utility. In not all, but most African markets, the public utility is bankrupt and operates at a loss because of a political policy decision to sell power below the cost of production. So you have to find a way, and this is one of the things that USAID has been working with several of their partners on, you have to find ways of trying to cross-subsidize so that you are expanding the consumer base, particularly low-income consumers. At the same time, you are not, scaring away your anchor customers that are going to be able to pay. That's a policy trade-off that countries all struggle with, and that's another reason that having like a guarantee from the World Bank or the involvement of an international lender actually helps to kind of unlock some of that. In terms of the technology choices, look, I think that that countries are trying to get the balance of the political need for delivering power today. You know, there's nothing worse than you're coming up on an election and the power goes out in the capital city every week. That happens in a lot of places. That creates a short-term political imperative. This is why a country like Ghana keeps leasing out these emergency barges. They're paying, 20, 22 cents a kilowatt hour for this power because they want the lights on ahead of the election. And you have to then balance that with the long-term choices of making good decisions that will support the economy over 20, 30 years. And I think a lot of countries, frankly, right now are having a lot of ideas thrown at them, smart grids and all kinds of new technologies, of which some have some very significant cost implications. And it can be difficult, just like in this country, to take a short-term decision, a good long-term decision because of short-term political demands. I think we see that in Washington, D.C. every day. That's true in every capital. So the extent that more data can be out there from EIA and others that can help countries make sound decisions, that's all for the better. And just one point on Linda's question around surveys. Look, doing primary surveys in a lot of countries is super costly, right? You're not going to send surveyors out to rural Congo to figure out who's using electricity. But you don't actually have to do that anymore. So if you have a clever combination of existing surveys supplemented with satellite data, with utility data, you start to build algorithms to model all of that, you can actually get at consumer demand almost in real time. And get pretty close at very, very low cost. So to the extent possible, I would encourage you to really try to look at the ways to exploit some of these new survey methods. We actually, at the Center for Global Development, we piloted with USAID. We did mobile phone-based surveys in 12 African countries just to get some very simple questions around, and we were actually able to extract a ton of money for very little, very, very little cost. And so once you start combining these, when you start combining all these data sources, you can get closer and closer and save yourself, you know, a $10 million primary survey in a difficult place.
Excellent. Linda, I'm going to give you the opportunity to give some final thoughts here, and then we'll wrap this up.
Me? Final thoughts? Well, my final thoughts are thank you for all this input, because you've given us a lot of pathways. I'm looking over at Vipin and David, a lot of things to be thinking about as we're developing the 2019. You know, you do so much work in your 2018, right, and you present it, and then to suddenly be moving right into the
tomorrow,
2019,
right,
you feel like, God, let's celebrate a little while for having completed something, but that's the way of the world. And we really are interested in figuring out better ways to have impact with the data.
Yeah, and I think we all applaud the notion of the deeper dive and getting a better sense of what's going on, understand the difficulty and the challenges before.
And I think some of the comments around disaggregation, I hear about China, you're right, it needs to stand on its own, and are we the ones that are going to do it, or will it happen in a broader sense? And the same thing with Africa. I think the initial look by looking at the top countries gave us some perspective, but now the question is there a better way to go in and see things in a more individual way?
And for you all, we've given you some top level thoughts, a lot of information, a few of the deeper dives. We would encourage you to and solicit your input as this process goes forward. Thank you for your patience and for coming out today. And please join me in thanking the panelists. This is a great discussion.